I have a sobriety date. It's February 14th, 2011. I have a home group. It's the Cup of Hope group. We meet 7:30 on Sunday nights. It's an open speaker meeting. You know, thank you for allowing me to come down, Billy, and share. It's been really cool to get to know you and talk. And we had a nice little conversation today, and we got to talking about, you know, different communities and as well as how Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to be a member of a community. It taught me how to be right-sized and to try to be a another kink in the chain, right? Just another peg on the wheel, you know? And sometimes, like, I have an ego and my instincts do get out of proportion, and I have a process to bring me down right-sized and try to be of some service and see what I can pack in instead of what I can take from. My whole life, before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and even, you know, that's what the struggle for me is, you know, how can I show up and serve versus how can I show up to get what I need? Or get what I want, truthfully. So yeah, it's been awesome. You know, I'm honored to come down and, share with you folks, my experience. Page 29 is where my sponsor takes all of us when we work through the steps, and after we get to step 12, and speaking at meetings, you know, this is where he tells us what the lead is. You know, this is what he tells us what our purpose is to do, from a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous is, show up, suit up, you know, and explain to people how you got a relationship with God, you know, in a general way. I'm going to share my story with you, you know, and, so, you know, I figured, you know, being from Pittsburgh, I don't know if anyone's ever been here before. There's a lot of rivers, real blue collar type of town. I was raised by a man who was, worked for 41 years in the same place, called off work 8 days. You know, my mother was a very loving woman. She, worked a couple different jobs, but for the past 30 years, she just retired, as a IRS employee. And, older brother, older sister, or, you know, older sister, younger sister. And it wasn't so bad until I was like, you know, 3 or 4 is when all the problems started in my life. You know, the little shine started wearing off, and I wasn't the youngest, maybe, who knows? I don't know. But like, it can be summarized in a photograph. There's a picture of me on Christmas morning sitting in a Power Wheels Jeep with an army helmet on and a plastic toy army gun, you know, having everything that I could ever want as a boy on Christmas, nothing but tears running down my face. You know, I remember that Christmas morning looking over at my sisters and their piles of Barbie clothes and hair barrettes, and it just looked like so much more than what I got. You know, and I was already done opening my gifts, and they're still, I got smiles on their face, and that don't make me happy. Never really did. You know, I didn't find joy in others' happiness for a long time in this life, right? And it was something that I reacted alcoholically to all the situations that happened to me from a young age. You know, I just did. I acted self-centered, with self-centeredness, resentment, fear, where's mine? It just was a way of life, you know, and there was some, I don't want to be controversial, but dude, I do have some childhood trauma, you know, that I reacted alcoholically towards. You know, 12 years old, I got sat down with that wonderful mother and those two sisters, and my mom introduced me to my biological father, and my whole life I thought it was her boss, really. I didn't know the guy. I just know that him and my dad really didn't like each other, and they really weren't at the same place at the same time ever, and there was tension, you know. So that situation really kind of did a couple of things. It made my little sister cry, which was strike one. You know, it also made me realize that you're a fool if you ever trust another human being in your life. If you let someone into your heart or close to you, all that really means is they get an opportunity to hurt you. And from that point on, I didn't listen to an authority figure. I wasn't listening to principals, teachers, police officers, or parents. I wasn't. It just wasn't going to be a part of me. Other people, I wasn't going to take no crap from anybody, you know, and I was hurt, and I didn't have the language to express that in any uncertain terms. And but I did have an outlet, and that was friendship. So I barely, you know, hung out with the kids. We started stealing beers and going to, you know, raised Italian. All my friends were Italians, and you know, Italians are famously known in this area, at least, to have a wine cellar. And in that wine cellar, there is homemade red wine. And and liquor from birthday, you know, Christmas presents and blah, blah, blah. And we used to go down to my buddy Benny's basement and to the, from the floor to the ceiling, man, just liquor bottles, champagne, wine, casks of wine, anything you could ever imagine. And, you know, we get our grubby paws on some of that and something happened to me. You know, and I can't, and I can only tell you that this is what it felt like. It felt like I wasn't bored anymore. It felt like fun. It felt like there was no more problems in this world. It felt like everything that ever wrong happened to me was okay now. You know, I took a drink of alcohol and everything was all right. And, there was nothing else that ever gave me that solution. Before alcohol, there was one thing that gave me that solution, and that was being an altar boy in the Catholic Church. I loved the Catholic Church. I was an altar server until the alms didn't fit anymore. And I'm a big boy, so I was like 12, 13 wearing a 16-year-old's alms, and they didn't work for me. I had to wear priests underneath their garbs. Anyway, so long and short of it is, I felt something when I was in the church. I felt something serving mass. I felt something serving the people of that church. And what it came, what I can like define now is a solemn, loving, comforting peace is what I found when I was young. Right. And some things started happening, like I mentioned earlier. And so like, you know, I started becoming a little bit of a rebel. I grew my hair real long, got it shaved up underneath, wore a ponytail, got my ears pierced, you know, had that little 12, 13-year-old Italian mustache working for me. And I would serve mass. You know, I was the type of cat that would run, ride my bike on summer break. We had 8:30 mass every morning at St. Ives. And I rode my bike to church when I needed to serve. And that was just it. Rode my bike home, and I would, when I got there, I would look for Grandma Thomas to sit in the front pew, and if I would misstep or do anything, she would give me a little point, tell me where to go and what to do, and I felt comfortable, and it just felt good to be a part of that, you know. I served mass for the bishop of the Diocese of Pittsburgh one time, and he embarrassed me and ridiculed me in front of the church. He told me that he was happy that I was wearing my ponytail and had my jewelry on. And some of the parish laughed. It was a really big mass, a couple hundred people in there. And, I felt so small, and I was holding this book, and this man was judging me, and it just didn't feel right anymore. And I already didn't feel right about God because of what happened when I was 12, and I started blaming and acting real alcoholic. And I was saying, why is all this happening to me? You know, and I said some things to that man, and I never served another mass again. You know, a couple of years later, the drinking kind of still started progressing. I already had the allergy to alcohol. When I started drinking, I didn't stop. And I was taking notice of how much other people had left because I knew they were going to quit and I was going to have to step in and, you know, be of some service, you know, and do what I needed to do to keep getting what I needed. And then at 15 years old, I found out that like, I was going blind. Didn't really know what was happening other than that I couldn't really see at night anymore. And, I couldn't see the words on the chalkboard and the old school overhead projectors with the marker writing on it. I couldn't see any of those words. And I have a pride of an alcoholic, you know, that I thought it was just because I was Italian. It turns out it's alcoholic pride, right? I can't ask for help no matter what. I can't admit my weaknesses. I can't admit my faults. And I've come to believe that there was these, men in my life that acted a certain way and I wanted to be like them. So I acted like them. And on the outside world, I was just a pretender. And on the inside, I was dying. On the inside of what was going on in my life, the only thing was manageable was the way I was going to set the stage. You know, I would set that stage really well, man. I would have all the players in place. You know what I mean? Same stage Bill Wilson talks about, just different characters. You know what I mean? I would set the circumstances just right so I could just ease on through. And when everything lined up and I hit that sweet spot, man, it was a good day. And when it didn't go right, it was everyone else's fault. And why are you doing this to me? You know, and I can't, you know, I would step on the toes of my fellows and they would retaliate seemingly without provocation. And that's how I acted. I didn't do nothing to you. Why are you doing this to me? Little did I realize that I was trying to control everyone and everything around me and just to get a drink and just to get a drug and just to, you know, get on top. You know, I learned that competition streak, that if I wasn't first, I was last. It was real ingrained in me. And I'm starting to connect the dots and put the pieces together today that isn't, those aren't assets. You know what I mean? And then going blind, it didn't matter. When the doctors told me like, yeah, you're going to lose your sight. And I just kind of something I could crack a beer at and say, you know what? It's Miller time, you know, whatever it was, you know, it didn't faze me. What I could hide behind was a shield of alcohol that would never absolutely let me to get hurt again because I had defense. And alcohol was my defense. It took away all the things on the inside, you know? And I don't know, man. I was the type of cat that grew up in a household that what went on in the house stayed in the house, and you acted differently when you left. No transparency, no honesty, no value, no genuine nature. You know, no genuine nature. And I believe that I adopted that as a way of life and internalized it. And on the inside, I did all that stuff that was in the house you didn't tell nobody about. And on the outside, I put a smile on, or I put a scowl on. And I would rather be feared than loved and respected. And, you know, I was a bully. I was a taker. And on the inside, I was having some stuff going on. I couldn't really describe it. And I didn't know how to talk about it, you know, and so that having those things happen to me in my life was just a better excuse for me to, you know, to ingest ethyl alcohol and, have a good time with all that. 19 years old, car accidents came around. I think all good drunk stories have some car accidents in them, and mine's no different. And, you know, the gal that was in the front seat when I was in the back seat of this car accident on the evening of Thanksgiving of 2003, man, the driver and herself both got life-flighted, and she didn't make it, you know. And I walked away from that car accident with some scars on my legs. I broke both knees and my fingers. And I walked away. I refused treatment from everybody and, you know, the ambulance and all kinds of stuff like that. And I just had this pride and this, you know, no one can hurt me worse than I can hurt myself. And, alcohol gave me a sense of relief and ease and comfort through this. And I knew better than I couldn't have went to the hospital. You know, I just, what they would have done for me in the hospital wasn't what I wanted at the time, you know, and I ended up going home and didn't want to ruin Thanksgiving for the family, you know, and I was getting very dramatic and melancholy and all the attention was on me. And that was a good thing for me at that point in time. And, you know, life was unmanageable at 19, you know, and through that process, like through that accident, through all these marks, all these excuses and all these things, I just kept drinking more and more and more. You know, I went to the doctors, had them give me some Xanax, get my nerves was, you know, I just lost a friend, I'm going blind, and the doctor's going to refuse it. And that's how I thought. And, just added to the problem, you know, burnt relationships, burnt friendships, going from one group of friends to the other. Not really understanding that I was lying to myself and everybody around me, because the more I drank, the more I put on this facade, the more I put on this facade, the more I had to live up to something that I knew I didn't deserve. Just like the fifth step in our book describes, like, to the outside world, we present this stage character. These are the ones we want our fellows to see, you know? And that was me to a T, you know, I was counterfeit, you know, is how I like to describe today, gold plated. On the outside was nice, good and shiny, but the inside wasn't worth nothing, you know? And it's how I live, man. It's how I survived, you know, and it didn't get any better. You know, I kept drinking. I kept doing the things necessary to take the first one. And, you know, guilt and shame started piling up, and I started, you know, I hit a couple of detoxes in that stint. They gave me the cure for alcoholism in that detox in my mind, which was Librium. Catapress kind of took the things away that were making me go crazy, but I did realize something, that sobriety was the issue. Went into that detox center knowing that I didn't want to drink anymore. I was done. I was tired of screwing this up. I was tired of hurting myself. I was tired of hurting the family. And you know what? I really just wanted some relief. And so I went into that detox and did what the doctor said I needed to do. And 24 hours later, I felt fine. I wanted to go home. And by the time I went home, there was somebody waiting, and we went off again. And it was just never ended. And there was a line in the book that really sticks out to me. Every time I sobered up in a rehab or a detox was, weren't we only concerned with ourselves, our resentments, our self-pity, you know, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. You know, I was driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, right? And that was it. It was that cycle. The delusion of the alcohol, the way I thought the world worked, because I was under the impression I really knew how this whole thing worked. You guys just needed to get on board or step out of the way. It would always lead me to lying, cheating, stealing, living a dishonest life, and it would always end up in a self-pity mess, even if I won. In my mind, I would sit in the winner's circle with my head hung low, and nothing was good enough anymore, and that was the end of the end. You know, suicide was the only thing on my mind. I don't kill myself well. It's not a joke, but it's the truth. And I started doing some things that were unnatural to me. I started doing some things that took away the alcoholism. you know, it wasn't alcohol. You know, I used to get, there was a Johnson & Johnson commercial my buddy just told me about from the 1920s, and they marketed it to give the wives to cure alcoholism for their husbands. And all it really was heroin in a bottle. It was morphine. And I think it might even, though that was on the label. And, it didn't work, obviously. But I thought it was going to work for me because it gave me a brief respite of sanity and allowed me to drink like a gentleman. You know, I was so afraid. I don't know if anyone has the experience, but I was unable to see real good. And, I was in these loud bars and there was a lot of stuff going on around me, and I had a draft beer, and I would drink the draft beer, and all I could think of was the next draft beer. And they would pour me a draft beer, and I would slam it down, and I just wanted another one. And I was having a hard time getting the bartender's attention. I didn't know if they were in front of me. I didn't know what was going on around me, and it was insane. It was literally insanity. I hated every minute of it, you know, because I didn't care about those people. I didn't care about the music. I didn't care about anything else other than that drink of alcohol, you know. And sometimes I'd be mesmerized at the fluorescent lights, tap dancing across the top of that beer, and that made me feel okay for a moment. And, you know, that was my experience. And like, you know, my solution to that experience was go to a different bar. And what I would do, and I was hang out in these bars with these old dudes, and we would sit there, and I would have a shot of beer, an ashtray, and a pack of cigarettes, and I would sit on the corner stool, and that's as big as my world in Billy Kay's in Verona. My world was as big as that, you know, and I was okay with it. My doctor sat over at the poker machine, so that wasn't a big deal. If I needed anything else to calm my nerves, it was only a gesture away. And I made that as a lifestyle. You know, I was permanently disabled as a juvenile, collecting Social Security at the age of 18, never thought my life was going to get any different, any better, or any, and was going to be successful. I didn't know that my life was going to be anything other than pain. Good man bartender, that bar pulled me in the back room one day and said, "Steven, one day you are going to die. You can't keep up what you're doing for long. I've been in this business since 1980 something. He said, "I've seen people like you come in and out, and they usually leave in a coffin. You got to do something, and you're going to die soon." He's like, "You're one of my best customers in the world. I love watching Pirate games, you know, baseball games with you. I love your company. You're funny as hell, but I just can't see you die." And this was a guy that I pretty much probably paid his electric bill every week, you know, or every month or whatever. And it started getting a little more serious. You know, I started like losing a little bit of weight, you know what I mean? I'm sitting out in the sunshine, chain smoking cigarettes. My parents are like, "Well, look, you might be doing good." I'm not coming home as drunk anymore. I'm not making fools of myself. I'm not blacking out. I'm just covering up things using different stuff, right? And what happened to me was miraculous. In my mind, I wasn't waking up with that horror, those four hideous horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. You know, I wasn't waking up every morning with pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization for a time. And then I started. And a new beast awoke. And things started missing from my parents' house. And, you know, I ended up, I'm the type of drunk that took some things that didn't belong to them and had great shame behind all that. My grandmother's a beautiful, beautiful, wonderful woman, passed away in 2009. She was my grandma. Like, we hung out, watched Pirate games. I kept real close tabs with her. She woke me up every day to go to school when I was young. She was just in my life. And when she passed, I did some things that I don't, you know, necessarily believe are, you know, honorable in any way, shape, or form. And so what happened was, you know, the funeral, and I could not be in that funeral home for more than 15 minutes without running down to the bar. I just couldn't do it. My cousins were in town. There was all these people around, and I just couldn't do it no matter what. And, life got small, and life got real small, and I started going against my will. And truthfully, you know, I hated myself, I hated everybody else around me. And if you were that close to me, you probably hated me too. And there was, there was a couple of weeks after that, maybe a month or so, came to different doctors and different solutions and trying to get well again. And, you know, off the treatment I go about a year later, man, when things started getting even worse, and, in and out of a treatment center for a period of time. I heard a lead when I was sitting in this treatment center in that place. And this gentleman was awesome, awesome guy. I didn't think this program would work for me. I didn't think the steps would work for me. I didn't think this, AA was going to, I would go to meetings and people say, you got to get this book. You got to read this book. You got to get this book. You got to read this book. You got to work these steps. And I'm a guy that if I wasn't thinking about drinking, I was drinking, right? And if I, when I started drinking, I was only thinking about the next one, right? And I walked around the majority of my life feeling like a screen looking for a mouth. And I just needed some relief, you know, and I came into a treatment center and they sent me to AA, and I've been to some AA meetings. My first AA meeting, I was 19 years old. I was so paranoid at 19 years old. I was under the impression my mom called the president of AA or the leader of this club in Penn Hills, Pennsylvania, and told them to tell stories about me when I was drunk. And I was so horrified that I just left. I thought, you guys were reading my mail. You know, you were talking about that gangrene of the soul that I felt after the mornings of drinking, like I drank. And when I did take a drink, I didn't know if I was going to get drunk for a night or five nights, you know, and it was scary. You know, you guys almost ruined my drinking, but I did get a seed planted when I was 19, and then back to them treatment centers at 26 and all that stuff happened. And this gentleman started speaking my language again. He was reading my mail. He was telling me my story. He was telling me all about me from a podium, Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened, I had God intervened, and I had the willingness to tell this man that this isn't going to work for me. I can't get what you got. I can't read what you read. I can't work these steps like you work these steps. I can't go to meetings like you went to meetings. I had excuses, you know, and they weren't just little, didn't want to go to meet. I just didn't think I could. I didn't think I was going to meet you wonderful people, Alcoholics Anonymous, in these programs, in this fellowship, and in this life, that were going to be able to maybe even, I'm going to live off the kindness of others type of guy. And sometimes I have to be humble enough to ask for help. And that's what I learned this whole deal was. Maybe it just wasn't I was alcoholic, or maybe it just wasn't I was blind and no one understands. Maybe it's I'm alcoholic and I had this mindset that I thought no one understood. You know, and I put the tag of the earmark of blindness on what alcoholism was. And I put the earmark of a punishing God on the price tag of punishing God on just what alcoholism is in my life. You know, and that was a wake up period. And I asked this dude and I told this guy, and the next day this man dropped off a set of CDs of the Joe and Charlie Big Book Study. And I didn't have a big book yet, but I had a CD player and some headphones and a ton of batteries. And I started listening to these CDs, and these old dudes from wherever they were from, Texas, Wyoming, whatever, they started taking me through this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I related on a heart level to what these men said. They spoke to what needed talked to, in my experience. And so I started hearing things about like the bridge shore of reason or whatever, you know, in the chapter of the agnostics, you know, reason took us so far, but it wasn't far enough is what I got. And we needed to use some faith to get over to the other side to that illustrious, you know, a sore sight for tired eyes, or however eloquently that man put it. It spoke to me. And I knew what he meant. And he knew I knew I needed to ask for help, and I knew I needed to start praying. And I knew it lit me on fire, man. I knew there was a solution to alcoholics, for alcoholism and what I was going through. And, you know, I just kept going forward ever since, man. I had some setbacks, got out of some treatment centers, went to some halfway houses, but I never stopped. You know, from May 25th, 2010 to February 2011, I never stopped. I kept coming, you know, I kept coming no matter what, because I knew you guys had something. I just didn't understand surrender yet. I knew that my hands were doing something. My mind was telling me not to. And I was just, man, I didn't want to drink, but I couldn't stop. You know what I mean? And it was a good thing you guys didn't kick me out for failing. And then you, not only that, you sat me down and started laughing with me and said, we're all a bunch of quitters, man. The reason why we have these traditions is because we fail miserably. And you're sitting at a table with a bunch of people that just burnt their lives to the ground. Welcome. You know, hope this doesn't have to be a requirement, but it was my experience, you know, and that's what I was. I was broken too. You know what I mean? And I was suffering. I was at the end of myself, you know, and some experiences happened to me. You know, I met my first sponsor in a parking lot. And I come walking off of a little van that the treatment center took you to the meeting with. And this guy said, who brought this blind bastard to the meeting, right? And it was uncouth and loud and aggressive. And that was right up my alley. You know, the crazy folks in Alcoholics Anonymous that are a little, you know, screw loose type of cats. That was my people, you know. And I walked over to him and he said, come here, bro. And he dragged me to the trunk of his car and he popped his trunk and he said, put your hand inside there. And I put my hand inside of that trunk, and there was a 12 and 12 and a big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in Braille. And from the top of my head to the tips of my toes, I felt the nearness of my creator. And he said, there's no such things as coincidences. They're all anonymous acts of God. And I said, whew, man, you guys might have something for me here. You know what I mean? And if I, every day, if I could have fed my spirit with what happened to me that day, I would have stayed sober. But, you know, lying and, was really a part of my life, and honesty was really painful to me physically, mentally, and emotionally. It was hard for me to be honest with people. And I half measured some step work, did a 15 minute fifth step with a priest. Obviously didn't, you know, it was lip service. The whole thing was, wanted to make amends to the people that I can get back with in a good way so I could take more. And I didn't stay sober. You know, my sponsor today talks about the promise of the fourth step, and the promise of resentments. It says, when we harbor such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And that insanity for me was the thought that precedes the first drink. You know, it may be, no one will know. It'll be between me and God. If he's real, he'll take this guilt away from me taking something. That was my rationale. You know, and I come dragging my butt back in February, and I was willing to do anything. You know, I detoxed in a recovery house in Washington County, Pennsylvania. These kind people put me in a room that I didn't have to walk up all these steps, and it had a bathroom on it. And they thought they were doing me. They did me a solid favor. They really did. But the room itself didn't have any direct heat going to it. So there was a fan blowing in some heat from the outside house. And it was the middle of February in Pittsburgh, man. It was cold, but I was willing. And that's the truth. You know, detoxing in a room with no heat in the middle of February in Pittsburgh was what I was willing to do. And I was willing to go to meetings, and I was willing to do these steps, and I didn't think they were going to work for me. And I didn't have any equipment to write my fourth step and to, you know, put these things in black and white with pen and paper, right? These superstitions and traditions that we're fettered to in our religious and spiritual practices that I have absolutely been able to take into Alcoholics Anonymous with me and show how big God is. You know, I don't need a pen and a piece of paper to help me write an inventory. You know, God blessed me with a computer today. And back when I did my first inventory, God blessed me with an 80-some-year-old man with hearing aids that I sat across the table from, and he wrote my inventory for me. And before we set that inventory, the 17 days sober, we did a third step again. And he wrote my inventory for me, and about 5-6 hours later, we fourth and fifth stepped some of the major resentments, fears, and things that were going on in my life. And when it came to sex, I wasn't going to talk to this man because his wife was upstairs and he had hearing aids, you know, and I was horrified, and I didn't know how to talk to a man about this. I didn't have it in me. I had too much shame. I had too much embarrassment. You know, I'm either the best or the worst, man, pick one, you know, and if I ain't first, I'm last, you know, and I definitely wasn't first my whole life. And I don't like talking about the L's. And, today, no, I know that, especially when I talk to new guys, man, tell me about them L's. You know, I don't want to know about all the W's, you know, and I don't want to know about the wins. You know, tell me about some struggles, you know, and that's what I was failing to do when I was there. But the job was done. You know, and turns out this 80-year-old man was married to a 50-year-old woman, and he had 7 children. And I should have been talking to him about, you know, my sex conduct. He knew a thing or two, right? And it's just like I didn't know that. I didn't know what it was to be a man of character. You know, I was always basing my ideals of what a man should be versus my biological father, which was a, you know, source of money for me and respect, and he was an authority. And I was a big Italian man, drove a Cadillac with his name on a license plate, and always handed me $200 and told me to take care of my mom and my sister. Versus my father, who was a hard-working blue-collar man, worked 41 years in the same factory, called off work 8 days. And I bounced between those two people in front of others, and especially in front of women, and tried to turn myself into who I thought they wanted me to be, and it always led me to failure. You know, I was always had that pit in my stomach that I was a castle made of tissue paper, and I was gonna just one rainstorm would take me out. Might be real good looking, but don't let any weather hit it. You know, and that was my experience. You know, and I ultimately after that fifth step, fourth and fifth, I did 6 and 7. And I was set right to do 8, man. And that's something I'm trudging through, something I didn't think was going to work for me. And I didn't think that God was real, and he definitely wasn't going to help me, because I was a guy that was blind. It was, you know, hardships and all these alcoholic and you don't understand, you know, and God started showing up in a big way. That first time I stayed, you know, that first day I stayed sober, I started moving my feet and the universe moved underneath him. I swear to you, I don't know how to explain it. I can just experience it, you know, and I'm doing my best to explain it, I guess. But there was some cousins of mine that were having a housewarming party in Leesburg, Virginia. And my cousins are all great people. They all come from, you know, they went to good colleges. They made good careers for themselves. And they joked around when we were young that I was going to be the cousin that sleeps on the couch and asks for money later on in life. And it was, you know, this is before drink. Like I don't know. I guess I was that way, you know? And so I went to this little town in Virginia, and we're driving down with me and my four aunts, and we're chain smoking cigarettes, and underneath my breath the whole time, I'm, God, if you're real, you gotta be there. Please, 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 if you're real, be there. Come on now. I need you more than ever. I need you to show up. I need to know you're real. I need to know that you love me, and I need to know that I can trust you. You know, and I'm verbatim just saying that over and over and over again for 5.5, 6 hours. And I got to my cousin's house, and I walked in, and I hit a priest with my cane. You know, I used a mobility cane, and I ignored it. Probably went and grabbed a drink, maybe used the bathroom, and went about my business, right? Because I'm there to make amends, you know, and I don't need, you know, priests getting in my way after I'm talking to God, you know. And so 10, 15 minutes later, my aunts came over and said, this guy wants to talk to you. He's going to be here for a little bit. Would you mind talking to him? And they knew that I just got sober again, and I was having some issues. I went and talked to this priest and got on my knees, and he put his hands on my head, and he started praying for me. And 15 minutes went by or so, and I got up and told him, Padre, I got way bigger issues right now, and I started dumping on him. And I told him what was happening in my life, and I told him that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm on a life and death errand in my mind to make these amends, right? And I knew that if I didn't stay sober, if I didn't make these amends, I wasn't going to stay sober, and I needed to stay sober. And I needed to trust God, and I needed to know he loved me. And this man stopped me, and I swear to you, I felt his smile. And what he said to me was, in 1978, I was a roadie and for a band. And I was a heroin addict and an alcoholic. And in 1978, I turned my will and my life over to the care of God, and I haven't had a drink or a drug since. And in that moment, I ran into a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in a different state, man of the cloth. From the top of my head to the tips of my toes, I knew my creator existed and he loved me. And I knew I was on the right path, and I was going to keep getting these love shots the more I kept doing what I needed to do. But that thought got smashed with, you're going to be a priest. You know what I mean? Like, he was going to turn me into something that I was afraid of, man. And I was just that was one of the big things, man. What if I do turn my will and my life over? Does this mean celibate? Does this mean, you know, whatever, no fun? Ned Flanders, like that, I didn't understand it, right? I was scared. That gave me some hope and some love, and it was beautiful. You know, it was a real beautiful day. It was a nice weekend. Went back to Canonsburg and Pennsylvania and just started just on fire for AA, man. You know, GSR got, you know, opportunity opened up at the home group, and I had some home group members of that group that were sober longer than I was alive, and it was an honor and a privilege to be there every morning. I got there every Saturday evening. I got there at 6 o'clock for an 8:30 speaker meeting. Jim Lowry didn't pull no punches. He said, I don't care if you can see, you're gonna learn how to set these tables up. He didn't say it like that, but that's how I took it, right? Just real big love shot, man. No one pitied me. If I was coddled when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd be drunk right now. Not that they were profane or harassing or mean. They just were honest, loving, and bolstering. You know what I mean? Very encouraging. And I started setting up that group every Saturday. You know, three chairs per table each side, three tables, six tables, three, you know, two rows of six tables and one in the front beside the podium. And that's what I did, man. And I loved it. And I loved AA. I fell in love, man. I fell in love with your coffee. I fell in love with your people. I fell in love with your stories, you know, and Alcoholics Anonymous was something that I couldn't live without. You know, and that first couple of years of sobriety was really well. And then it wasn't, you know, I was sponsoring 11 different guys and I was doing everything I thought I should be doing. And I was dead on the inside and couldn't get out. And I needed to keep applying more of these principles. And what I found out from that experience that I wasn't continuously doing 10, 11. You know, I was going from, I went from 1 to 12 real quick, and I finished up my first set of 12, but I was staying sober on 1 and 12. And I missed the magic Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank God for this gentleman named Mark. He said, you know what? He said, what you need to do is, rework these 12 steps and start tap dancing on 11. And I started seeking, man. It got me into meeting. I met a teacher through this process, you know, my spiritual advisor, you know, 2 years sober, ran into him, man, literally again. God in my life, man. He started helping me out with some problems that was going on, and you know, and some things started getting panned out. And I started, my life got as small as the end of Billy Kay's again, you know, sober, you know, with a couple of years sober, them terrible twos really bit me, you know, and I was, my world was small again. It wasn't like Cannonsburg. It wasn't anything else's fault. It was something that I needed to do. I got a new sponsor. I blew my program up entirely, and you know, I ran through the steps again. And, you know, somebody told me throw the cards in the air, and where they land is where they need to be. And that's what I did. And through that process, I finished some applications with a guide dog, put some applications in, for some schooling and, some things I never thought I was going to do, man, become more of an independent person, right? I knew I needed to get back to Pittsburgh, and that's what happened. I got back to Pittsburgh through the luck of, you know, brother of mine, truly a brother of mine. He, you know, told me I could rent this house that I'm sitting in right now. And you know what? Some things went south and I was able to just purchase it, you know, and it wasn't because of any other reason other than the kindness of others and the love of a family that I thought hated me. They didn't pay for nothing, but they sure did co-sign, you know, and I haven't missed the payment. I haven't done any of that stuff, you know, and I came into this little town where I'm at, and the background that you're probably looking at, if you can see it, is the view from my front porch of the city of Pittsburgh. And everyone thinks it's so ironic that I got one of the best views of the city, and I can't see it really, truthfully, you know. At nighttime, I can see some of the lights and things like that, and I remember what it looks like, but I have no clue, you know what I mean? Maybe that's why it's me being unselfish. That's for others, you know. And I met some beautiful neighbors here, dude. It's just been a wonderful thing. My home group's five blocks away, you know, and I did relinquish the coffee commitment, and I was the type of cat that if you wanted to, you know, make coffee, you would have beat me there. You know, I can become obsessive and possessive over the key to the church and the coffee and stuff like that. And I learned through the 12-step process and good sponsorship that, you know, other people need to serve as well. And it's such a joy to be happy for someone else, you know, being of service. And that was something I was missing my whole entire life. And I can tell you one more thing, and probably going to wind down soon, but there was something about that amends that I made when I went to Virginia and I ran into that priest. I would still have this little hook in my heart when my mom and her sisters got together, and they were finally getting together to you know, pass on all the things that needed to be passed on, all the heirlooms and whatnot. And, you know, I just felt terrible, man. I had this pain that was still come up in my heart, and I was guilty, you know? Well, mom called me one night after they had their little meeting, and she told me, she said, Steve, you know, I went down to get all that jewelry appraised, right? Like all those things that I needed to get done. And I'm sitting there and I'm talking to the guy and I'm telling him that I got three kids and one lives in the south side of Pittsburgh, and he's telling me about his children, right? And he's telling my mom about his kids, and they're just chatting along, and he slides the bill over to her and it says amount due. The number there said 31 years sober. And my mom said, what is this? You know? And she said, and this guy looked at my mom and said, ma'am, I know your son. I spoke at his home group a couple of weeks ago. I want you to know that Steve is a very, very good man. And, he helps a lot of people and you should be very proud of him. And I think you need to know that. And I couldn't dare charge you a cent. And if you want to sell some of this jewelry, you can sell it right here in my shop. And I won't charge you a penny. You know, you can sell it for what it is. Put a sticker on it. You can keep every dime. And in that moment, my mom broke down and she said she saw my grandmother, holding hands with Jesus and, nothing but forgiveness and love, you know, poured over her heart. And she called me and told me that, you know, she told me that Stephen, I don't know what you're doing, but keep doing it. And all those things you did in the past were just casualties of the war, is how she put it. And she said, God freed you from the pits of hell so you can go back in there and start helping some folks. And, oh, man, did that just fire me up, man. Like, you know, you never know what you need until you get it. You know what I mean? In my experience anyway. And it was just such a beautiful, wonderful thing that just, you know, these things keep on giving, you know. And I was taught to, you know, say a prayer and move your feet, you know what I mean? And keep doing what you're doing. You know, I have a purpose today in Alcoholics Anonymous because of you wonderful people and it's 12 steps, you know, I have a way out, you know, I know how it is to be at the bottom and not be able to get up out of there, you know, man, So, you know, my life's going good, and this whole thing's a little bit of a setback with the corona and all that, but I have great faith, and I think we're going to be all right. You know, I'm looking forward to, you know, graduated from school and finally got my licensing for the state for massage therapy. And like, you know, I'm just, man, I got some hope in my heart still. I don't think there's too many things that can take that away, you know, and, thank you for the opportunity for sharing that you're meeting Billy. And, thank you. I believe you said your name was Gary for hosting, and I love you lots. And thank you.